You are listening to the Monaco Daily, first broadcast on the 30th of April 2024 on Monaco Radio. Can Israel, Hamas and Hezbollah reach a truce with France's help? Can China's Xi Jinping be wooed with French cognac and a visit to the Pyrenees? And would anyone with any sense pay $1,000 for a restaurant reservation? I'm Chris Chermak. The Monaco Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monaco Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. My guests today, Leila Malana Allen and Philippe Marlier, will discuss the day's big stories and we'll hear from the head of the Bled Strategic Forum of Slovenia about why security forums are such big business. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monaco Daily. This is the Monaco Daily and I'm Chris Chermak. I'm joined today by Leila Malana Allen, Monaco's Middle East correspondent, and by Philippe Marlier, professor in French and European politics at University College London. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hello.
Leila, it is very good to have you here as our correspondent. First time on the Daily. Listeners will be familiar with you, but why don't you introduce yourself for the Daily guests?
So I'm Leila Malana Allen. I have been a correspondent for Monaco for years, originally in Beirut, and latterly I'm now a Middle East correspondent roaming all over the place. Obviously, pretty much priority now at the moment has been Israel and Gaza for the last few months, but popping all over the place, Iraq and Syria. So it's nice to be in the studio in London, rarely.
What is it like to be hopping around from place to place at the moment? I mean, it's crazy, frankly. The situation is quite crazy. What is it like for you to be hopping from place to place?
Depressing, heartbreaking. It's strange to have lived in the region for a decade and all these things that we saw building up and nobody else really saw building up, sort of all colliding at the same time in all these countries. I spent the first few months of the war just in Israel and the West Bank, and it's utterly heartbreaking how everyone's lives are being destroyed by what is in the end a political fight between extremists on both sides. That's very, very hard to see, and you spend all your time with the human beings who really are the ones who bear the brunt of it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And we will get into some of that on this show. But before that, Philippe, you have a little bit of a more positive story of travel to tell us from the last week. You were in Lisbon.
Yes, absolutely. On the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the so-called Carnation Revolution, Carnation because that flower was prominent in that military coup to restore democracy 50 years ago in Portugal.
And yes,
it was distributed to the militaries.
Covered with our own Portugal correspondent, Carlota Ribello, on Friday, listeners will know
absolutely.
As well. Like, what was it like for you?
It was very nice. Lisbon is such a beautiful city, and I think it was quite amazing to try to think about that place in southern Europe, you know, which was under dictatorship for decades, and democracy was restored only in 1974. And, you know, the tiny streets of Lisbon where sort of tanks were brought, you know, in early the hours of the 25th of April in 1974. So they tried to reenact a little bit of that. There was also lots of singing, lots of popular songs. It was joyful. So it was really about restoring democracy. And it was also a last point is that revolution happened because younger militaries were fed up with the colonial war, which Portugal was waging again in Angola, Mozambique, and other countries in Africa. So it all started from that, in fact. So it's very nice to be there and to share the sort of remembrance of the return of democracy in Portugal.
Share in a celebration, absolutely. Well, we will start this show in the Middle East, where talks over a possible truce between Hamas and Israel are ongoing. Hamas is reportedly considering a new ceasefire proposal in exchange for the release of hostages, although their considerations probably haven't been helped by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowing to invade the southern city of Rafah with or without a ceasefire agreement. Meanwhile, France's foreign minister, Stéphane Séjourné, was in the region over the weekend, hoping to leverage France's historical ties and avoid an even greater regional escalation with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Leila, before we get to France's role and Lebanon, what is your sense of the chances of a truce between Israel and Hamas before Netanyahu decides to invade Rafah?
We've heard repeatedly, oh, this is the closest we've ever been to a ceasefire. Obviously, we haven't had one since the end of last year. At the moment, we know there are around 130 hostages still in Israel, still in Gaza. We think at least 34 of them are dead. This is deeply, deeply difficult because the hostages that have been released so far were all very much considered civilians. You know, they were women and children. Now we're getting into the much more difficult territory of the fact that the ones that are left are mostly men, some elderly, and the women are mostly of serving IDF age, which means that Hamas considers them to be combatants. Now, whether or not you agree with that, that's how Hamas feels about it, and they are certainly incredibly valuable to Israel, which Hamas knows, which is why we're hearing rumours of thousands, potentially, of Palestinian prisoners in Israel being released in exchange for these people, and indeed for the bodies of the people who might be dead, because in Jewish tradition, it's incredibly important that the body is buried as whole as possible. So it's vitally important to those families that they receive the bodies of their dead family members back if they are dead. Now, what we're hearing at the moment is, obviously, America is the kind of greatest participant from the Western side at the moment. It's been heavily brokered by Qatar, but these talks are being brokered in Cairo. And what we're hearing at the moment is that the deal is moving a little bit more towards having an extended period of calm, which is a different term they've come up with for is it going to be an actual ceasefire or not. Hamas keeps saying they want a permanent ceasefire. Israel says impossible. Currently, they're proposing 40 days and as few as 30 hostages being released in return for maybe hundreds of Palestinian prisoners to at least try and start this. Now, Israel Katz, who's
still just frankly a step, isn't it? Again, then we're not talking about something permanent here at all.
If it happens, it's a step. Exactly, if it even happens. Now, Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, said a few days ago that if they got the deal through, there would not be an invasion of Rafah right now. Benjamin Netanyahu has suddenly turned around today and said, oh no, I'm invading Rafah whether or not we do it, which essentially is incredibly like scupper the deal because that means that Hamas doesn't really have any reason to agree. One of the main things they've been pushing for is the return of civilians to the north of Gaza and the pulling out of the battalion that's currently holding the centre of Gaza. If there's an invasion of Rafah, that's obviously not going to happen. More troops are going to pour in, so it's not looking great.
Philippe, France's foreign minister, Sejourne, was meeting with Israel's foreign minister today as well. What do you make of France's involvement here? How much pull do they have?
Well, it seems that France's diplomacy is trying to revive its historic link with Lebanon, you know, stemming from its mandate a while ago. There is a strong population of Franco-Lebanese there as well. So I think France has probably an interest in that. But it seems that, you know, France being France, it also tries to broker a peace deal. If it could help, that would be interesting. So I think what I understand is that essentially Stéphane Séjourné, the foreign minister, is trying really to implement finally the sort of UN resolution, the so-called 1701 resolution, which in fact is about the cessation of hostilities, war, which is still ongoing between Hezbollah in the north of the border and Israeli forces. So I think that UN resolution, if put in place, implemented, would mean that the Israeli forces, which are occupying part of the Lebanese territory, would have to withdraw, and they would the all the Lebanese factions and groups, military groups, will have to be disarmed. And that includes Hezbollah. So that would be, a major step in ensuring that peace is restored, or at least calm, because at the moment, I understand they are the tension is rising, and there's a risk of, you know, what is going on in Gaza could now spread in that region, and that would probably, of course, mean a kind of start of a regional war, because, of course, if now it's there's war between Lebanon or faction, Lebanese factions and Israeli army, I think all the other countries, notably Iran, might want to also intervene.
Leila, there is this risk, absolutely, of an escalation, isn't there? What is your sense of how much of a role Hezbollah is playing in this conflict at the moment? How much of an interest do they have in getting more intricately involved, or would they want, you know, a country like France to come in, give them some sort of peace plan that they can be vaguely happy with while this is going on in Gaza, although they have said that they will not do anything until there is a ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, there are multiple questions there. To start with the first one, in terms of what's Hezbollah's role. Now, I lived in Lebanon for many years. I spent a lot of time down in the south, you know, reporting on Hezbollah. This resolution, I mean, this is the name of the game. It's been the name of the game since the end of the Lebanese civil war. And of course, remember, Israel and Lebanon are still officially at war. Israel pulled out in 2000 from its occupation of South Lebanon. And then in 2006... they bombed Lebanon again. And it was Hezbollah that saved Lebanon in the local law. You know, the Lebanese armed forces really are absolutely kneecapped because their Western allies will not give them enough firepower to do any more than be defensive, which means they're never going to be able to stand up against the Israeli armed forces. That's always been the problem. So that's why Hezbollah has so much power, and they're getting it all, you know, all the money from Iran, all the weaponry. I mean, I went to a display of Hezbollah military might in Lebanon last year, and all the southern mountains are just full of weapons. You know, we estimate they've got 10 times as much as they had in 2006. Hezbollah will never, ever give up their weapons. Mm. It's never going to happen. And anyone who thinks it is living in a dream world. Mm. So the reality here is, do they want to fight? Which was your second question. Right now, no. Mm. Hezbollah is not in a position where fighting would help them at all. They currently have a leading role in the Lebanese government, which is very unpopular with many people, but the reality is that was a democratic election. That's really helped them. They've been trying to make themselves into a democratic party for years, rather than being seen as a militia. They actually, you know, really have changed a lot of their tactics as a result, and anybody who thinks that Hezbollah is sort of wild and unruly and whatever would be, you know, behaving very dangerously, because the reality is they're in fact incredibly kind of militarily controlled, and nothing happens without Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, the Sayyid, saying so. So whatever they do is very strategic. They have been reacting to what has been a really big assault from Israel, and increasing on the south of Lebanon. You know, I've been up to that border on both sides. There's a lot of destruction happening in south Lebanon, several people dying every day. Mm. And Hezbollah at the moment has just been returning fire and keeping it quite measured. They cannot be in a position where they are seen to instigate, because as one of the leading parties in that government, they cannot be responsible for the deaths of thousands of Lebanese people, which is what would happen if there's all-out war. However, if Israel pushes the mark too far and they can be seen as being defensive, that would then change the game. So that's where that balance is at the moment. And just on your point about France, Hezbollah does not care remotely about what France has to say. France is very much the ally of the sort of Western-friendly, particularly Christian groups, but some of the Sunni groups as well. Hezbollah thinks that's all a joke. You know, as far as they're concerned, they can sort of come in and have their nice little peace talks. The reality is they're the ones with the weapons, and they're the ones with the actual defensive capability for Lebanon and, you know, the government sort of playing its games up in Beirut.
Just a quick final word on that, Philippe. I mean, France has often kind of, frankly, have they lost the ball a little bit in that they get involved at certain moments. They were there after the port explosion in 2020. There's a flurry of diplomatic activity. But to Leila's point, it's not that people in Lebanon even necessarily feel that France has a strong role to play, do they?
No, I agree with that. I think it's pretty clear that, and I agree with Leila's point about France not being seen as a serious peace broker, in a sense that it is seen as a Western power and defending Western interest there. Mm. And so, frankly, yes, I understand. And the faction which has the weapons and the means launching an attack against Israel is Hezbollah, and that's it, and not the Lebanese army. So, for all these reasons, yes, I think it's probably a diplomacy for the media, for the world, but not certainly not something very effective.
Well, sticking tangentially with the Middle East now, because university campuses in the United States have been alight over the past week with protests and arrests of pro-Palestinian students. But the demonstrations have more recently shifted to Europe as well. Students at Sciences Po and the Sorbonne in Paris, in particular, have been inspired by what started at Columbia in New York. The French government has shown little understanding, accusing students of bringing a North American ideology rather than acting of their own accord. Leila, you are an alumnus of Columbia. That's where all of this began. So let's start with that. What have you made of what was happening there?
I mean, Columbia is a very interesting place. It's a university that obviously is, you know, right in the centre of New York, and it has a very interesting staff body because, as well as the undergraduate school, it also contains SIPA, which is the public international affairs school, and so that attracts sort of very political figures from around the world and international relations scholars on all sides of, you know, this conflict. And then it also has the journalism school there. It's a real place for kind of politics and international thought. It also has very strong student body groups in Arab politics, you know, the Palestinian cause, very strong student politics on the Zionist side, very strong Jewish communities, obviously, in that area. So it really is a sort of both deeply intellectual and kind of, you know, sometimes melting pot, sometimes grinding stone of those different communities who are all extremely highly educated, very empowered. And so I'm not at all surprised that this is where this kicked off. You know, I remember being a student there, and when there were sort of controversial talks or whatever else at the time, the Iranian president tried to, ex-Iranian president tried to come and make a speech, and, you know, there were huge protests about him coming and the fact that he was a human rights abuser. On the other side, huge protests saying we must have an open platform. So it's always been somewhere.
And was this Ahmadinejad when he spoke to the UN as well?
Exactly.
I remember that very well.
When he tried to come and speak. So, you know, and if you look back, you see over the decades, there have been many encampments like this before, for both for Palestinian issues and other issues. Now, again, also what we've seen a lot of these kind of protests in the States where you see, it's, you know, to a European, to a British mind, quite mad crackdown of armed police on civilians, you know, unarmed civilians, but particularly now for it to be college students. And for that to happen, not somewhere kind of in the South or whatever else where perhaps we've seen, but, you know, inside an elite New York university, I think has been very startling for a lot of people. And it raises a lot of questions about whether, it, you know, it's your right. We've had all these questions about safe space. Is it your right to feel safe and undefended at university? Probably not. It's certainly your right to be protected by your university and not have armed police assault you because you're protesting. And it's been very interesting to see the faculty kind of come out, and some of them now being locked out of their offices, being, you know, because they're trying to protect their students. So I think it really brings up fundamental questions about not just this particular political battle, but what universities are for, because they have always historically been a place of both learning and political thought and protest.
Philippe, when it comes to the riot police as well, that is something we have also seen in France, them being called to campuses. That is a big deal for France as well, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Well, riot policies are sort of intervening in public demonstrations. That's, we've seen that many times, and with sort of very heavy-handed tactics most of the time. What is new, and I agree with Leila here, is that it's the police being sent to campuses and to also arrest students or remove them, and quite physically, brutally. It happened this week at Sciences Po, which is a sort of school specializing in political science, social sciences, the kind of equivalent of the London School of Economics here. And it is quite shocking because I think there are two golden rules in universities, at least in France, which is, but I think it's everywhere, which is, first of all, there's freedom of speech, you know, and as long as you don't break the law, you should feel free to express your opinion, even if that opinion, even if the government doesn't like this opinion, which is the case, it seems, on the question of the Palestine-Israel conflict. And the second rule is that you don't send the police to campus. This is another thing. You know, even Charles de Gaulle in May 68, at the height of the students' protest, didn't do it. And his regime was at stake then. So you see that's really, that shows the sort of the journey we've done since, you know, the 1960s, which were really a decade of very intense students' protest, you know, and in a very heated atmosphere most of the time. So it is about curbing public freedoms. It is about curbing freedom of speech. This is very worrying. And again, I'm not making any assessment of what the students are trying to do. I suppose it's quite logical that the students would take side with Gaza and the Palestinians and what they are at the moment. it's really for the principle of freedom of speech. And there are very worrying developments in France, in the US, and everywhere. You know, I think we could also talk about Germany. You know, they're very worrying developments. And I think this is not the best way for any democracy to uphold, you know, values of free speech, etc.
Just to follow up on that quickly, Philippe, were you surprised by the French Prime Minister, Attal, sort of, who is an alumnus of Sciences Po himself, suggesting that this was sort of importing a North American ideology? I mean, it was quite a dismissive way to look at what's happening.
It's a very interesting question, because I think if you look at Attal's background, it is very, very surprising that he should come up with this sort of remark. You know, why would he be? Because it's really playing for the gallery, to the sort of Americanophobia, so to speak, is quite something, you know, where you can sort of hope to gather together, you know, sections of the public from the far left to the far right and going through the center. That's why he's doing it, because I can't believe that Attal himself is anti-American. You know, his education, his upbringing, is a man of the world, he's traveled, he speaks English. So why would he do that? He does it for cynically political purposes.
Absolutely. Well, Leila, for one other thought on this before we move on, just tell me about how you feel that this might reach through to Gaza, to the Palestinians in the West Bank. What kind of impact does this have on the region, do you think, these protests?
Well, it's exactly that connectivity, you know. I mean, to Philippe's point, what a nonsense to say that these are American ideas. We know the French protest better than anyone in the world. It's what they do. But also, you know, as with so many other places in France, we have very rich, old Jewish communities. We have a lot of Israeli links there. We have, of course, you know, the entire banlieues, Arab communities, right, surrounding Paris. So many Lebanese people in Paris, so many Palestinian communities there as well, right? So as with everywhere else in the world, these are communities that are so dispersed. There are so many diasporas. So it's very, very kind of charged for everyone. And in sending those ideas over to Gaza, to the rest of the Palestinian territories, to the rest of the region, they are responding. In Gaza, they're holding up signs saying, you know, thank you to American students. Thank you for seeing us. Thank you for engaging. And that's not a publicity stunt alone. You know, what they're doing is they're trying to firstly engage, but also to say, we're part of an international community. We're not sitting here as victims. We're not just these faceless people who are dying all the time. We see you, you see us. They're saying, you know, we're sorry that you're suffering. We're sorry the police are doing this to you. They're showing that they are still human beings in the midst of all of this, and that actually this is a global conversation they want to have, and they want to take a stand and have that platform to be able to discuss it, rather than just being pushed away in this area where no one looks and they're just kind of, you know, reported on by the rest of the world. So it's very powerful that they see and feel this engagement with the rest of the globe.
Well, while France's Prime Minister tries to quell these student protests, next week, France's President Emmanuel Macron will be wining and dining with Chinese President Xi Jinping. It will be the Chinese leader's first trip to Europe in 5 years. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen is also part of the talks before the Macron show truly takes over. She will be feasted at the Élysée Palace before being swept off his feet with a visit to the Pyrenees Mountains. Philippe, what do you make of this trip? I also wonder if she is likely to notice that apparently French cognac will be served, the subject of an anti-dumping probe on the menu.
Yes. Well, I don't know if it will be served, but I suppose don't know if she will appreciate it. But yeah, I think it's a combination of diplomacy and business for sure. There is, I understand, the France's first electric car battery. A big one was opened in northern France, a formerly mining region. So it's a way for Macron to relaunch the French industry. And probably he might want China to invest in that. That would be, I think, the start of the discussion for business. As for diplomacy, I understand that Macron, again, would be interesting to sort of have a word about the situation in Ukraine, because I think that's one of Macron's, together with the situation in the Middle East, concerns, which is sort of put an end to that war, ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine. We know that China has been sending arms to Russia, so it's a problem. So probably, yes, he will have a word about that. And as for China, I understand that probably, well, that's also a way to put oneself in between, you know, Europe and the traditional allies, the US. So, you know, it's a sort of a power game and between traditional allies and probably new partners, China. It's very interesting also to see that it's a 5-day trip to France, Serbia, and Hungary. You know, France, I can see why Xi would want to go there. Hungary, difficult partner in Europe, maybe that's that.
Same with close Serbia, to Russia, for that matter, as well.
Serbia as well, yeah. So I think
two difficult partners and one not so difficult partner on this trip.
Yes.
Leila, what do you make of that? Or what do you make of China's foreign policy in general, I guess, watching also from the Middle East now being here? There is this sort of more muscular foreign policy right now, but at the same time, a certain sort of rapprochement with the Middle East and with Europe wanting to play a bigger role.
China is unbeatable. And the reason for that is because their business policy is that they don't get involved in politics. And when you are Western nations who moralize and who try to engage business deals and whatever else with, you know, sort of carrots and sticks for how countries behave, you cannot compete with somebody who says, I don't care. Here's a check. We just want your resources. We just want your land.
But they did also recently try to mediate between Hamas and Fatah, for example.
They did. They're very happy.
They're stepping in a little bit more than that.
They're very happy to step in, but they don't take a moral stand, is the point. So they'll take as much power as they can. They'll be anyone's friend, right? But they're not walking. As long as you don't bother with Chinese politics, as long as you don't try and get involved with their internal politics, they will be anyone's friend. And it's a very clever policy. And there are multiple strands to what's happening here. Firstly, you know, the French, there's been several issues with EU trade deals with China, where they've tried to sort of raise certain issues. And we know that Emmanuel Macron loves to stand up and kind of, you know, want to be the leader of Europe and kind of put himself forward. So by engaging with the French, they're trying to smooth that over a bit. But there's also a very interesting link here, which is Africa, because France is much more engaged with its former colonies than the UK, than Portugal, and China is all over Africa. Every single country you go to, there are bridges being built, there are roads going up, there are factories going up, everything's happening there, while many other nations have been a bit more hesitant to get involved because of many concerns over, you know, trade conditions, whatever else, which, to be clear, I do think we should be worried about, but China's not worried about. Secondly, then we've got this interesting situation with Serbia and Hungary, as I say, two pretty difficult partners in the region, but of course, they don't care about the politics, so they're not going to get upset about Viktor Orban and what he's been doing and his human rights abuses. They just want to make those deals. And of course, this is all to do with the Russia-Ukraine war, because everyone's starting to eye those former satellite countries, those former Soviet countries, and try and see what the deal's going to be made there, both politically and economically. We just saw David Cameron suddenly popping up in Central Asia. We're in the middle of a Middle East war, suddenly he's in Central Asia making trade deals. Very odd. But everyone's kind of eyeing that. So the Chinese are doing very well to kind of look ahead here and both try and establish themselves as, you know, they can come and they can do a state visit and they'll be absolutely courted, but and, you know, make those better relationships with the EU, but at the same time really try and stick their hands into as many places they can and really pave the way for themselves to have those deals and that political power, which they are slowly moving themselves into that position in advance of whatever comes out of the situation in the Middle East, the situation in Russia.
Philippe, just before we move on to our final topic, a final word on Macron. I just wonder what you make of his. He seems to be very convinced by the ability of personal relationships, wining and dining, going to the Pyrenees, the kind of steps he takes with world leaders, whether that was Donald Trump, even Vladimir Putin, for that matter, before the war started. Is he overreaching sometimes in what he believes is his ability to influence these leaders through this personal approach?
You're right. It's very personal. I was thinking whether it is Macron style or a French trend. I think that his president is doing that. I think it's a bit of both. I think there's always a sort of idea that if you there's a state visit to France being, you know, a sort of large country by European standards, and there's a lot to see and to do, and you can dine, you can enjoy the food and the wines. So let's try to do that. If it can be part of the diplomacy to smooth, you know, and make relations easier, then why not? I think there's a very personal touch here. They're going both to the Pyrenees, where allegedly Macron, as a child, was visiting his grandmother. So
that is how personal
Yes, exactly. It's very personal. Yes.
Well, while Emmanuel Macron will probably have his restaurant reservations taken care of during Xi Jinping's visit, it is becoming a quiet hell for the rest of us living in big cities, so much so that there is, of course, an app for reselling your reservation. Appointment Trader is the marketplace that earned $6 million last year by taking a cut from people reselling their restaurant reservations for as much as $1,000 for the Carbone in New York. Do either of you want to take a stab at defending the $1,000 reservation before we continue?
Absolutely not.
So I have only one slightly charitable way to try and defend this, which is that there's a certain egalitarianism for those of us who can never book on time because we are always late with any plans that we make, that now it's money instead of simply whether you think 5 months in advance about where you want to book a restaurant. But that said, I do not have $1,000.
But that means you can't be disorganized and poor.
You cannot be disorganized and poor. You can be disorganized and rich. This is what this creates, yes.
Yes. I was thinking the reservation might be more expensive than actual dinner, you know, if it's $1,000 or unless it's a very fancy restaurant. I can't see really the point, or it's not me at least, to book a restaurant 5 months in advance. You know, how can you do that? I think going out and eating out is ought to be something spontaneous, and maybe a day or a couple of days before you do the booking, but month in advance, it's crazy.
So you are not in favor of reservations for any price, Philippe?
No, I wouldn't pay money for that. We pay all the time fees for reserving, you know. Our tickets to cinema or to any kind of an exhibition, that is fine. But here, you know, the idea that there could be a business out of that, you know, people reselling and it's a very, very hefty price. No, I think it kills the joy of going out and eating out, I suppose.
It does kill the joy, but at the same time, Leila, you were describing the frustrations I heard earlier of trying to book a place here in London while you are in London. What would you do to get a reservation if you're not going to pay $1,000? Would you, I don't know, a circus act stand on your head? I mean, what would you do to try and get that through?
I'm going to have to get some better adaptable skills to be able to sing for my supper. I was actually speaking to my father about this the other day, who, you know, really lived in the heyday of the 60s and 70s in London. He was saying London's just not fun anymore. Everything's so expensive now that it's kind of, you know, and everything's so manicured and scheduled and all of that spontaneity's gone. I remember when I came back from New York sort of 15 years ago, and this is always been a thing in New York, or for a very long time, and being so relieved to be back in London where things were a bit more. And then, you know, I left London a decade ago, and I've been spending a bit more time here recently, and it's just horrifying. I think it comes, but a big part of it obviously was COVID, where we all suddenly sort of, in the same way that we allowed government tracking to sneak into our lives, we've allowed this sort of obsessive booking culture to sneak into our lives, which was important at the time because there were so few people going out and we had to social distance. But now it really isn't necessary, but it's become the norm. So all of this, you know, trying to book weeks in advance for anywhere, and oh, you can have a 45-minute slot from 9:45 until 10:30, but you have to put down hundreds of pounds or whatever else. You know, it's always already wildly expensive. But I think it's also part of it really is overscheduling our lives. Whether it's a case of you know, being nervous that we won't have plans. I mean, I've just been trying to make plans with a group of five other friends. It took us 2 hours. We did multiple WhatsApp polls, and we have finally found a date where all six of us are free in 3 months' time. And I joked that, oh, I look forward to seeing you all in 3 months' time, where I suppose some of us will be married and have children by that point.
And you still probably won't get a reservation for the restaurant.
Well, no, exactly, quite. So this week we were trying to get somewhere. I'm eventually going to cook at my house because it's just less, you know, it's less. I'm now going to spend several hours cooking because that's
probably
just so much less stressful than trying to find somewhere where we can get on the list and where, you know, everyone's definite, so you don't put down your credit card and then you lose it. I just think it's such a shame because it, as with everything else, it takes so much of the joy out of, as Philippe said, being able to stroll roll into somewhere, do something impromptu. And for me, having lived in the Middle East, which is, you know, deeply European for years, that's the joy, calling someone up, let's pop in here in an hour, let's go and have fun. Otherwise, you know, I just feel that it's all become a bit over-corporatized, and it's a great shame, and it takes so much of the joy and spontaneity out of life.
Just a final word from both of you. Is there a restaurant that you have been to, that you snuck into, a favorite place that you either reserved or didn't need to reserve, Philippe?
No, I don't do booking for restaurants. Well, I do them, you
or
know,
one
the
you
day
snuck
on the
into
day.
That you're particularly proud of, that you did not have to reserve.
No, because going out for me and eating out is really always spontaneous. So I haven't, you know, my fights are all to try to secure tickets at a popular theatre play, which is quite difficult in London too. But I think that's worth the fight for me. It depends on your interest, you know, your personal interest. I suppose this is where my interests go, rather than sort of fighting a month in advance for booking a place in a restaurant.
Layla, a favourite place you snuck into?
My favourite is still Moro on Exmouth Market. It's an oldie but a goodie, and they will always, you know, you have to book there weeks ahead of time, but if you go and float by the door and you get a glass of wine and you stand on that cobbled street, they will find you a spot at the bar, and that is still one of my favourite things to do.
Layla Malana Allen and Philippe Malliard, thank you very much for joining us. And finally, on today's show, earlier this month, Monocle attended the Delphi Economic Forum in Greece, just one of a myriad of regional security conferences jockeying for attention these days. These forums are big business, it has to be said, and while we were there, we spoke to something of a rival in Peter Gerk, Secretary General of the Bled Strategic Forum of Slovenia. That forum is celebrating its 20th anniversary later this year. Monocle's Andrew Muller began by asking Peter how it feels to visit another forum and what sort of lessons he's looking for.
I think at the end of the day, there are two things which are important, or three things, for the success of the forum. One is, of course, the attendance, mm-hmm. who is coming. Basically, you always want to have as high political guests as possible, but on the other hand, you also want to have a lot of people from civil society, because mm-hmm. I think this inclusivity of this kind of forums is very important in order to actually discuss comprehensively the things and the issues and the problems which the society as a whole is facing. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, of course, logistics. Mm-hmm. You want people and participants to feel at ease and happy, like that everything is working, you know, because you don't want people to come to the forum feeling that they are not appreciated, that nothing is working, and so on and so on. So it's a big endeavor, and you have to balance, of course, the both things, because if there are too many people, then it's hard to actually maintain this balance and efficiency of logistics. You're always afraid that something is going to go wrong, like it did a couple of hours ago when the electricity went down. You know, you're always preparing yourself, oh my God, what I'm going to do if the electricity goes down. But at the end of the day, you have to be prepared for this kind of things, and you have to be flexible. So when we are talking about Delphi and the Bled Strategic Forum, more or less, I would say we are quite similar conferences with similar attendance, and both places, of course, are beautiful. So this is also one thing which I think is important when preparing a conference, to do it in an environment where people feel relaxed, where the people feel that they can say more than their official line, so that you can really get from the guests as much forward-looking answers and discussions as you need.
When you're dealing with the teams surrounding these individuals in particular, how minute can the protocol get? Do you ever run up against somebody who doesn't want to sit next to the Prime Minister of somewhere else? That kind of thing?
I mean, you always get this kind of problem. So I think the biggest problem which we encounter every year, so every year we prepare for that, is, of course, one is the seating arrangement, which needs to be done particularly efficiently. And the second thing is, of course, who's going to speak first? It's always about this, especially when the same level people come. It's always about sitting in arrangement and who is going to speak first. And this, it doesn't matter on the level of or from which country they're coming. It's always the same. I want to speak first. So there is a lot of coordination with this kind of people. That's one problem. And usually you're doing that with their chief of staff or their protocol departments, and this always takes a lot of effort and a lot of time. And the second one is, of course, we have always some set of rules, how many people can come and so on and so on. Especially from the countries which tend to have big delegations, this is an impossible task. For example, I don't know, Turkey, US, you say 1 plus 3, they tell you the delegation is going to be 1+25, and then you have a problem with the hotels, then you have a problem with the everything, you know. So it's quite a challenge, but at the end of the day, flexibility is the name of the game. So making compromises, and we tell them you should make compromises because we are going to come halfway, you should come halfway.
I mean, there are a lot now of security, diplomatic, economic conferences. I sometimes wonder if you could actually literally spend an entire calendar year bouncing from one to the other. In fact, there's been a couple of years I felt like that's what we've done. That being the case, how hard is it to carve out your own individual niche? Is it important for people to think one particular thing about the Bled Strategic Forum, that this is the place I go to for this reason?
Yes. One thing that we are proud of ourselves, and one thing that we actually want to maintain, actually make it even more important, is the inclusivity. Bled positioned itself as a conference where you have on the same stage people from politics, high level up, but also people from civil society and professors and business people, because we think that the worst case scenario is if you have on the panel only politicians who more or less speak the same language. You need a little bit to broaden things up. You know, sure. There is a lot of conferences, I agree, there is a lot of meetings, and I think the civil society or the citizens, the people often wonder why. Why are we doing so many things? Is this something which is producing change? And I would say yes. You know, it's not on the first glance that this kind of conferences like Delphi or Bled are going to bring change, but they are a small piece of the puzzle on how to actually bring the issues which we think are important, not just for Europe, but for the world, to, let's say, a bigger audience and to the citizens. So it's all about give and take with the citizens. We are doing this so the citizens understand that we try to influence the politics through discussion, through inclusive dialogue, and basically try to make some change and contribution.
Well, just finally then, is there anything you can tell us now about this year's event?
Yes, it's going to happen on the 2nd and 3rd of September. We usually start doing this conference right after the last conference, and the title is going to be A World of Parallel Realities, and this comes back actually to what we were discussing before. You know, we are living in a highly, I would say, volatile environment globally. Europe wise you have a neighborhood which is more or less burning, and it seems that as a society we are drifting more and more apart, and we are not actually listening to each other. So what we would like to do is to see where is this possible compromise in order to move forward, because if we are not going to move forward as Europe, but also as a global community, and now Slovenia is a part of the Security Council, and we see how hard this is. I mean, there are issues like Gaza, like Ukraine, where everything is stuck, everything is divided. But if we are not going to get this act together and try to devise a system, multilateral one, which is going to bring answers and not just stand on two different shores of the sea, we are going to encounter really, really big problems. And these problems we would like to avoid, because if you take the lessons learned from the past, this kind of times where everything is changing, where the old world is dying and the new world is not there yet, always brings a lot of issues, and in the past they have been dealt with in violent way, and this is something that I think needs to be avoided at all costs.
That was Peter Girk of the Bled Strategic Forum speaking to Andrew Muller. And that's all the time we have for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panelists, Monocle's Middle East correspondent Leila Malana Allen and Philippe Marliere of the University College London. Today's show was produced by Paige Reynolds and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Flynn Simons, with editing assistance from Tamsin Howard. I'm Chris Chermak here in London. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.